Hi, everybody. My name's Julia. I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Julia.
Nice to see everybody. And so this is our fourth and final night. And so we've just been kind of going through the steps and talking about the spiritual malady. And we started with, diagnosis, surrender, coming home. And then tonight is gardening, which is how we think of 10, 11, and 12. When I think of gardening, I think of patience, which is something I don't have, but steadfastness, and some caretaking, and like listening, if that makes sense. Seeing what's needed on a daily basis, weeding, obviously, nurturing, but cultivating a relationship with something that's growing and that needs to be taken care of. And which is very much how I see my recovery. It's not something I can ignore. When I think of an orchid, I'm not gardening an orchid. And Gordon, an orchid, so I always think you just neglect, like benign neglect. Yeah. Recovery's not like that. You know, recovery is more like something you got to be checking out on every day. And so I'm just going to dive in with 10, 11, and 12. In the spirit of 10, 11, and 12, and 10, I just wanted to kind of do a little 10 step with this group from something that happened last week where I felt we colored out of the lines. And I just hope we didn't cause offense. It was not our intention. But one of the things I've learned about in recovery is that intention's all well and good, but a lot of times we make mistakes, and you know, we don't realize it, but you know, we have to hear when we've made them, and it is brutal to take that feedback sometimes. I gotta tell you, all the time for me, for this oversensitive alcoholic. And we have to learn to be receptive. You know, we have to get God-centered and not self-centered. And that's a practice, you know. That's a practice, and it's just so uncomfortable. And I've mentioned many times how, like, discomfort for me is the theme, you know, of being in recovery. It's like I got to get used to being uncomfortable and being resilient with it, because otherwise I'm just going to stay where I am, which is not pretty ever. So step 10 starts just on page 84, in the middle of page 84. In our book. So we've just finished off the 9-step promises, extravagant promises, kind of, yeah, right? Blah, blah, blah. This thought brings us to step 10, which suggests we take personal inventory and continue to set right any new mistakes as we go along. We vigorously commence this way of living as we cleaned up the past. So he's not short on adverbs, like vigorously, you know? We have entered the world of the spirit. Our next function is to grow in understanding and effectiveness, which is, such an oft-quoted line, and so true. Like, it's to think about that we're constantly needing to grow. He doesn't say, like, we need to just hang where we are. You know, we're good. This is not an overnight matter. It should continue for our lifetime. Continue to watch for selfishness, dishonesty, resentment, and fear. When these crop up, we ask God at once to remove them. We discuss them with someone immediately and make amends quickly if we have harmed someone. There's never, you don't get to hang out with this stuff, you know. Then we resolutely turn our thoughts to someone we can help. Love and tolerance of others is our code. That's actually one of my favorite lines in the book. And we have ceased fighting anything or anyone, so we start to get the 10-step promises, even alcohol, for by this time sanity will have returned. We will seldom be interested in liquor. If tempted, we recoil from it as from a hot flame. We react sanely and normally, and we will find that this has happened automatically. We will see that our new attitude toward liquor has been given us without any thought or effort on our part. It just comes. That is the miracle of it. We are not fighting it. Neither are we avoiding temptation. So this is, I have to say that I've kind of experienced, you know, that this miracle and these promises, and it's just astounding to me when I think back and compare how life used to be. We feel as though we had been placed in a position of neutrality, safe and protected. We have not even sworn off. Instead, the problem has been removed. It does not exist for us. We are neither cocky nor are we afraid. That is our experience. That is how we relax, so long as we keep in fit spiritual condition. So I'm reminded this is like the flip side of when we talk about the solution being on a different level from the problem. You know, we talk about that, like the problem is here and, you know, the solution needs to be larger. So if we're living in the solution, the problem, you know, if that problem was alcohol, right, which we know it really isn't, but at least that problem, you know, has been removed. It is easy, again, another warning, it is easy to let up on the spiritual program of action and rest on our laurels. We are headed for trouble if we do, for alcohol is a subtle foe. We are not cured of alcoholism. What we really have is a daily reprieve contingent on the maintenance of our spiritual condition. Every day is a day when we must carry the vision of God's will into all our activities. Mm-hmm. So we start to have like these musts, must-dos, and a lot of them are spoken of in increments of a day. You know, this is where we really see like the day at a time program, because he starts to talk about this daily practice, like this gardening theme, that it's, we never, and this all fits in with like, it's interesting. Well, like I'm interested in neuroscience. This is not AA, but you know, and that's where we learn about neuroplasticity, you know, like we have to do this all the time. Mm-hmm. You know, we have to get out of our own thinking minds, our own limited views, all of these things. And the patterns in our brains are so powerful. There are lots of terms for them in different spiritual practices, these habit patterns that we have. You see them in all, you know, spiritual traditions. And they are way more powerful than, you know, our willpower, you know. And so that's why we need a God-sized, you know, God-sized solution. I think Barefoot Phil used to say, like, if you think God can't handle your problem, you need to get a bigger God, you know? Hmm. Every day is a day when we must carry, okay, how can I best serve thee? Thy will, not mine, be done. These are thoughts which must go with us constantly. We can exercise our willpower along this line all we wish. It is the proper use of the will. Much has already been said about receiving strength, inspiration, and direction from him who has all knowledge and power. And he continues, further means more action. So we have a lot of action, inaction, constantly. Step 11, suggest prayer and meditation. Suggest, right? A little more than, like, suggest wearing a parachute. We shouldn't be shy on this matter of prayer. Better men than we are using it constantly. It works if we have the proper attitude and work at it. It would be easy to be vague about this matter, yet we believe we can make some definite and valuable suggestions. So this is when they talk about the nightly inventory, which is often, you know, people think of it as step 10, but it's literally in step 11. But when we retire at night, we constructively review our day. Were we resentful, selfish, dishonest, or afraid? Do we owe an apology? Have we kept something to ourselves which should be discussed with another person at once? Were we kind and loving toward all? What could we have done better? Were we thinking of ourselves most of the time? Or were we thinking of what we could do for others, of what we could pack into the stream of life? But we must be careful not to drift into worry, remorse, or morbid reflection, for that would diminish our usefulness to others. And what I find, I highlighted that sentence because, again, I'm reminded that that would diminish our usefulness to others, but we're at the point, like, really, this, it kind of echoes where I was when I had just stopped drinking, when drifting into worry, remorse, or morbid reflection could have brought me to another drink. And hopefully I've moved past this by the time I'm at this step. But ultimately, staying stuck in remorse and that could take me down that road, right, if I'm not careful. Mm. After making our review, we ask God's forgiveness and inquire what corrective measures should be taken. On awakening, so we start to get into this 24-hour. Let us think about the 24 hours ahead. It doesn't say, let me think about the 8 years ahead. Let me make some long-term goals. It says, let me think about like what's in front of me immediately. We consider our plans for the day. Before we begin, we ask God to direct our thinking, especially asking that it be divorced from self-pity, dishonest, or self-seeking motives. And again, this is where So I'm really interested in motives, and we'll talk more about that. Self-seeking motives. So he's not saying, you know, something I could get called out on, like self-seeking behaviors that others can see. No, motives. Like this has to be, you know, roots. Mm-hmm. Like at our roots, we have to be coming from the right place. We have to find new foundations. Under these conditions, we can employ our mental faculties with assurance, for after all, God gave us brains to use. Our thought life will be placed on a much higher plane when our thinking is cleared of wrong motives. So somebody once said to me, their definition of humility, I think they heard it from a faith leader of some kind, who said, humility is using your gifts to the best of your ability, but always knowing from whence they came. So the idea being that you can use all these gifts, and in fact, that's kind of our mandate, is to use the gifts, but not to take credit, right? And to examine them, what their end use is, right? What your motives are in, you know, leveraging your talents. In thinking about our day, we may face indecision. We may not be able to determine which course to take. Here we ask God for inspiration, intuitive thought, or a decision. We relax and take it easy. We don't struggle. So, again, I was thinking here about habit pattern and how, I don't know about you guys, but for me, when I'm engaged, when I'm in a place of self-will and in my old way of thinking of, you know, getting what I want, when I want it, how I want it, it's exhausting. And there's no, in my body... I have no sense of relaxation. It's very tense. I know in my being when I am in self-will. Most of the time, if I can really take a breath and pause, I can tell, like in my body, if I'm in my will or God's. And when I get real controlling and I set my plan, that is not a relaxed place to be. So he's not saying here, you know, oh, just let it go. You know, do whatever. What he's saying is, like, take a pause and notice in the course of action that feels the calmer, more serene one. Right? He's not, like, telling us to just, you know, hang out on the sofa. In thinking, relaxing, we don't struggle. We're often surprised how the right answers come after we have tried this for a while. What used to be the hunch or the occasional inspiration gradually becomes a working part of the mind. Being still inexperienced and having just made conscious contact with God, it is not probable that we are going to be inspired at all times. So I love like when he uses these understatements. He's like, it is not probable, you know, maybe. It's just like, yeah, probably not probable at all for a while. We might pay for this presumption and all sorts of absurd actions and ideas. Nevertheless, we find that our thinking will, as time passes, be more and more on the plane of inspiration. We come to rely upon it. We usually conclude the period of meditation with a prayer that we be shown all through the day what our next step is to be, that we be given whatever we need to take care of such problems. We ask especially for freedom from self-will and are careful to make no requests. So he continues these, you know, what prayer is really for, right? That it's not to be self-centered. There are many helpful books. So he doesn't tell you how to do it, right? This is God as we understand him, or is it Dave who says, God as we misunderstand him, you know, whatever our conception is. Suggestions about these may be attained from one's priest, minister, rabbi, you know, whoever. Be quick to see where religious people are right. Make use of what they offer. They're super pragmatic here, right? Like just, you know, because these guys really pulled from a lot of traditions themselves. So he invites us all to do that, you know, to go to seek, right? We don't know if we're going to find, but we have to be in a place of seeking, moving toward God. As we go through the day, we pause when agitated or doubtful and ask for the right thought or action. We constantly remind ourselves we are no longer running the show. Humbly saying to ourselves many times each day, thy will be done. We are then in much less danger of excitement, fear, anger, worry, self-pity, or foolish decisions. We become much more efficient. We do not tire so easily. So that feeling, I can be exhausted when I've been in a place of self-will. And for me, that can show up as trying to control others, you know. It can show up as trying to seek approval, right? Please, you know, whatever that looks like. It can look like being perfectionistic. And it can be like, it can look like being ungrateful, which is also exhausting. So I find, you know, just being in a place of gratitude is a place that where I'm much more energetic. For we are not burning up energy foolishly as we did when we are trying to arrange life to suit ourselves. It works. It really does. We alcoholics are undisciplined, so we let God discipline us in the simple way we have just outlined. But that is not all. Not all. There is action and more action. Faith without works is dead. The next chapter is entirely devoted to step 12. So I'm going to turn it over to Jim, who's going to take 12. Why don't you just take it and we'll go back to it.
Yeah. I get the mic. hi, everybody. Jim Alcoholic. So I'm going to take a cruise through working with others. Not going to read the whole thing for time constraints. But I'm going to pick out some areas that kind of spoke to me. I went through this whole chapter earlier today, and like a lot of us, we experience different things every time we go through the book, even though I've read it 1,000 times. So these were just areas today that spoke to me. So chapter 7, working with others, on page 89. Practical experience shows that nothing will... Oh, also, just a side note. These are Julia's glasses. Because I left mine home. So, any screw-ups, it's Julia and these glasses' fault. Okay? Just wanted to clarify that before we get going here. So, practical experience shows that nothing will so much ensure immunity from drinking as intensive work with other alcoholics. It works when other activities fail. This is our 12th suggestion. Carry this message to other alcoholics. You can help when no one else can. You can secure their confidence when others fail. Remember, they are very ill. Life will take on new meaning. To watch people recover, to see them help others, to watch loneliness vanish, to see a fellowship grow up about you, to have a host of friends, this is an experience you must not miss. We know you will not want to miss it. Frequent contact with newcomers and each other is the bright spot of our lives. And so this little piece just gives me that sense of community that I have found in the rooms of AA. And we talked early on about how we, you know, in our addiction are completely disconnected. There's no community. There's not a lot of connection. And certainly in my case, I was completely isolated in any meaningful way. So I just love how they, right in the beginning here in step 12, they kind of hone in on this sense of community and being together. On page 92, it talks about continue to speak of alcoholism as an illness, a fatal malady. Talk about the conditions of body and mind which accompany it. Keep his attention focused, or her attention focused, mainly on your personal experience, and explain that many are doomed who never realize their predicament. So I remember listening to Chris S. doing a workshop, and he always stressed that it was his experience that so many alcoholics are not aware of what kind of trouble they're actually in. Do you know what I mean? It's like, yeah, I drank a little too much. Do you know what I mean? Stayed too long at the party. And nothing could be further than the truth. I mean, that, and certainly my own personal experience was, it was only as I got sober and started to get into the program that I understood the actual predicament that I found myself in. And it was far more than having a substance problem. You know what I mean? So I just love that this is, this really spoke to me today. If the man be agnostic or atheist, and this is obviously speaking about, you know, working with a newcomer, or it could be someone who's been around the program for many years, but maybe hasn't had any kind of transformational experience yet. If the man be agnostic or atheist, make it emphatic that he does not have to agree with your conception of God. He can choose any conception he likes, provided it makes sense to him. The main thing is that he be willing to believe in a power greater than himself, and that he live by spiritual principles. When dealing with such a person, you had better use every language to describe spiritual principles. And so, you know, for me, I'm sure this is not true for anyone else, but for me, when I showed up here, I was the higher power. You know what I mean? I wasn't looking for anyone else for my direction. I knew what was going on. You know what I mean? Which was another part of the predicament I found myself in. So outline the program of action, explaining how you made a self-appraisal, how you straightened out your past, and why you are now endeavoring to be helpful to him. It is important for him to realize that your attempt to pass this on to him plays a vital part in your own recovery. Actually, he may be helping you more than you're helping him. Make it plain he is under no obligation to you, that you only hope that he will try to help other alcoholics when he escapes his own difficulties. So I love the fact that they're actually really speaking to, in this case, the sponsor, you know, and letting him know that this is very important. You know, in my case, if I'm sponsoring someone, it's very important for me to understand that this is really important for my recovery, even though I'm working with someone else. That it's not some situation where I have all the answers and I'm going to, you know, I don't know, just enlighten someone I'm just going to be amazing. I've had a lot of practice with Julia being amazing, and so she's put me in my place, and I'm learning slowly, but I'm learning. It's really, I've had the privilege over the last year or two of sponsoring a couple of men, and it's clearly been a huge, it's allowed me to take my level to another, or my recovery to another level, because it helps me, it's one of the few things that keeps me from thinking about myself. It's like, I'm not much, but I'm all I think about. Yeah. That's one of my favorite sayings. My experience with working with others has been a real gift. On page 95, there's just a little spot here. Any place where I saw the word God, I underlined it. And I wanted to hone in on those specific areas. So if the guy I'm working with, or gal I'm working with, well, I can't work with gals. No. If the guy I'm working with, if he is to find God, the desire must come from within. So that's a really, I think, important line in the book here. I can't give anyone a desire to do anything. You know what I mean? I can only share my experience with them and try to lead them to a better place. But the desire for all of that, in order for him to find God, is going to have to come from within him. And so that's something I would really strongly just stress. You know, that if you, this is all about, you know, we talked earlier this morning in a meeting about that this program is not for people who need it, but it's for people who want it. And so that desire is really key. If you don't have that, well, it says right here, you're not going to find God. Do not be discouraged if your prospect does not respond at once. Search out another alcoholic and try again. You are sure to find someone desperate enough to accept with eagerness what you offer. We find it a waste of time to keep chasing a man who cannot or will not work with you. If you leave such a person alone, he may soon become convinced that he cannot recover by himself. To spend too much time on any one situation is to deny some other alcoholic an opportunity to be happy. And so, another key point is, it's not about me being successful necessarily with working with someone else. What's most important is that I do it, and that I do it in a way that's not trying to jam something down somebody's throat. If I see that there's not a lot of receptivity on the other end, I can I can move on. It's no harm, no foul. It's not about me, because I can tell you that I could have a tendency to be very codependent and want to, like, hey man, you know what I mean? And it's telling me right here that's not the way to approach it. It's not gonna have a good outcome. Page 98. It is not a matter of giving that is in question, but when and how we give, how to give, that often makes the difference between failure and success. The minute we put our work on a service plane, the alcoholic commences to rely upon our assistance rather than upon God. So that's a real key piece. We don't want the alcoholic to be relying on us. We're supposed to be leading the alcoholic that we're working with to his own experience with God, with a higher power, whatever that looks like for us. He clamors for this or that, claiming that he cannot master alcohol until his material needs are cared for. Nonsense. I love the word nonsense. I underlined that. Some of us have taken very hard knocks to learn this truth. Job or no job, wife or no wife, we simply do not stop drinking so long as we place dependence upon other people ahead of dependence on God or our higher power. Burn the idea into the consciousness of every man that he can get well regardless of anyone. The only condition is that he trust in God and clean house. Over on page 99, the bottom, let no alcoholic say he cannot recover unless he has his family back. This just isn't so. In some cases, the wife will never come back for one reason or another. Remind the prospect that his recovery is not dependent upon people. It is dependent upon his relationship with God. We have seen men get well whose families have not returned at all. We have seen others slip when the family came back too soon. Both you and the new man must walk day by day in the path of spiritual progress. If you persist, remarkable things will happen. When we look back, we realize that the things which came to us when we put ourselves in God's hands were better than anything we could have planned. Follow the dictates of a higher power, and you will presently live in a new and wonderful world, no matter what your present circumstances. So that makes pretty clear to me that this idea that I, as long as I trust in my higher power, I'm going to end up in a better place. As simple as that. Not complicated. Assuming we are spiritually fit, we can do all sorts of things alcoholics are not supposed to do. People have said we must not go where liquor is served. We must not have it in our homes. We must shun friends who drink. We must avoid moving pictures which show drinking scenes. Are they movies? We must hide their bottles if we go to their houses. We mustn't think or be reminded about alcohol at all. Our experience shows that this is not necessarily so. We meet these conditions every day. An alcoholic who cannot meet them still has an alcoholic mind. There is something the matter with his spiritual status. So the idea of being able to avoid all the challenges in life in order not to have to drink, they're being very clear about this. They're telling me that if that's the case, I still have an alcoholic mind, and that's a problem. You know what I mean? That's not going to work so great. So what the goal is, and initially I could see, you know, as a newcomer very early on, makes perfect sense to avoid situations that can be really challenging for you. Things that for someone many years into sobriety could be no big thing. But obviously early on, some of the things that they're talking about here do have relevance. You know what I mean? And that's a great place where your sponsor can be of great import. You know, to be able to, like, bounce that off him. You know, like, what? I'm going to do extra, you know, or I was thinking about doing such and such. What do you think of that? You know, is that smart? But ultimately what they're saying here is we want to move past that, and there will come a day when that's not as big a problem, which is when we know we're starting to move down the spiritual path a little bit and getting a little bit better. Is our belief any scheme of combating alcoholism which proposes to shield the sick man from temptation is doomed to failure? So that's pretty clear, right? That doesn't mince any words. In our belief, any scheme of combating alcoholism, which is our disease, which proposes to shield the sick man from temptation, is doomed to failure. I got that underlined. If the alcoholic tries to shield himself, he may succeed for a time, but he usually winds up with a bigger explosion than ever. We have tried these methods. These attempts to do the impossible have always failed. So our rule is not to avoid a place where there is drinking. If we have a legitimate reason for being there. You know, going to a bar and hanging out like where we used to hang out with our buddies, but just like having a, you know, seltzer and a lime, especially early on in our recovery, probably not a great idea. It wouldn't be something that I would consider a great idea. But again, that's another great place to use your sponsor. Why sit with a long face in places where there is drinking, sighing about the good old days? If it is a happy occasion, try to increase the pleasure of those there. If a business occasion, go and attend to your business enthusiastically. If you are with a person who wants to eat in a bar, by all means go along. Let your friends know they are not to change their habits on your account. At a proper time and place, explain to all your friends why alcohol disagrees with you. So, I'm the one with an alcohol problem. People that I'm with, you know, if that's not one of their issues, you know, that's not something I don't need to be making a big deal about my alcoholism. Especially when I'm with people who, that's not an issue for them. You know what I mean? It's just a more kind of egoic way of bringing attention to myself. And it's just another sign that I have a lot of work to do. Your job now is to be at the place where you may be of maximum helpfulness to others. So never hesitate to go anywhere if you can be helpful. So again, it's different. It a lot depends on where we are in our recovery. Are we early on? Are we just getting into the game? Are we well down the road? And we have a lot of experience. But ultimately, what they're trying to kind of foreshadow is that We want to be back in the stream of life. Mm-hmm. You know, we don't want to be making everything about alcohol and, you know, look at me, you know, I haven't had a drink in 20 years and I'm amazing. It's just to be in the world as a normal, productive member of society. You know, no major, you know, rock star entrances, not a lot of, you know, that's all egoic nonsense. That's not a sign of recovery and maturity. That's a sign that you haven't gotten there yet. You know, so why hold a sign over your head like, I'm an idiot, I'm immature? You know, that's what it's... And because we don't sometimes know that when we're in that place, it's understandable. I've certainly been there. You know what I mean? I was in AA meetings, leading meetings, and I was still on pills. You know what I mean? So, I mean, I have a pretty keen sense of how lost you can be and how you might think you know what's going on and you have no idea what's going on. So I have painful first-hand experience of that. So on the final page, 103, we are careful never to show intolerance or hatred of drinking as an institution. There's nothing wrong with drinking. There's a guy that Julie and I love, who talks about substances as being fairly benign in and of themselves. It's our relationship to the substance. It's my relationship to the substance. Alcohol by itself, sitting in a glass, it's not bad. It's not anything. It's just there. You know what I mean? It's how I relate to it, how I use it. Do I use it to run away from my life? Then that's a problem for me. It's not a problem for someone who's not an alcoholic. Do you know what I mean? So I don't want to come from a place of like hating alcohol and working with a sponsee and telling them, "Yeah, this is not good. You know, this is like the devil." No, it's because my alcoholism is in me. It's not an alcohol, the substance. You know what I mean? Experience shows that such an attitude is not helpful to anyone. Every new alcoholic looks for the spirit among us. So, and it's immensely relieved, and he is immensely relieved when he finds we are not witch burners. So nobody new in recovery wants to be told that alcoholism or that alcohol itself is some really bad thing. You know, they're not going to be receptive to that. It's what it's telling me here. A spirit of intolerance might repel alcoholics whose lives could have been saved had it not been for such stupidity. We would not even do the cause of temperate drinking any good, for not one drinker in a thousand likes to be told, not one drinker in a thousand likes to be told anything about alcohol by one who hates it. You know what I mean? So we want to be kind of neutral about the whole alcohol piece in terms of it being like some really nasty thing. It's something that is not good for us because we've proven, you know, by our history and our behavior that it doesn't work for us. Given our condition, given our disease, alcohol, it's not going to work for us. It's just not. After all our problems, so this really kind of wraps up the whole thing. After all our problems were of our own making. Bottles were only a symbol. Besides, we have stopped fighting anybody or anything. We have to. So, you know, we talked a lot about our problems coming from our thinking. You know, I had a situation, Julie and I went up to Montauk Friday, and I had done a job up there back in April, March and April, and there were 25 bathrooms that we did, and I thought on the way up there that all of them looked amazing. That was my understanding. And then I got up there, and I walked through them with the manager of the place, and half of them were not good. I had no idea that that's what was coming at me. And so I kind of, you know, we were there to have a nice time as well as do some business, because it was a place right on the beach and they comped us a room and blah, blah, blah. So I grazed right over the fact that this is a real problem that I just looked at. And I kind of hung on through dinner that night, pretty much. And then right about 9 o'clock, I started to dig into it in my mind. I was like, holy mackerel, this is a mess. I can't believe that I didn't freak out before now. You know what I mean? What was wrong with me? I should have been on top of this hours ago. And so I think I fell asleep at 11, woke up at 3:30, and then I was, you know, and I was going over all the scenarios and how are we going to do this and how am I going to make it. And I get up the next morning and I was able to see that what was, and I had a really horrible night. You know what I mean? And I was able to see that my thinking around this issue, what was causing this chemical crap storm inside of me. Not the guy that took me through the bathrooms. Not even the fact that the bathrooms weren't perfect. The bathrooms are just the bathrooms. If there's a problem, I'll fix it. Right? But that's not where I went. I went to the, oh my God, place. You know what I mean? And that's my history. That's why I needed drugs and alcohol and all the rest of it to deal with my mental sense of reality. You know what I mean? And so that's, again, another concrete example of my problems were of my own making. I didn't have to flip out. I could have, like Julie and I say, let's just act like non-alcoholics today. Try that out. Like, what would a non-alcoholic do? They just wouldn't do that. I've seen people go, we'll figure that out. You know, no big deal. We got 60 more bathrooms to do. We'll fix them. Nope. You know, and go to dinner and have a good night and then sleep like a baby. You know what I mean? That's not what happened to me.
Yeah.
You know, so again, when we talk about the gardening piece, we want to stress the fact that, and at least this is just me, but we want to stress the fact that this is an ongoing day-to-time process, whether you're 10 days into recovery, 10 years into recovery, or, you know, 30 years into recovery. You're going to have to deal with life. You have a brain. You're going to have to manage it to the best of your ability. And the better you manage it, the better you're going to feel. You know, if you manage it poorly, you're going to feel like I did the other night. You know, and I'm the one that can get out of there or take myself there. No one else. You know what I mean? And that's one of the beauties of this program, that it gives us ultimately the ability to have some say over how we are feeling and how we're doing. When I first came in here, I had no idea that I had any control over that, that I could pull myself out of something. You know, it's the we've all heard, you can start your day over anytime. You know what I mean? 1,000 times in the day if you need to. So I think I'm going to pass it back to Julia to maybe share some of her experience with maybe step 10, 11, or 12. Julia?
So I think one of the most important parts about gardening is, remember, we're just tending the thing, and God or the higher power, some force, is the thing making it grow.
Yeah.
And we're just doing our best to take care of it. And I also think that the second half of step 12, you know, we talk about practicing the principles in all our affairs, brings us, kind of wheels us right back into all the steps and to our behaviors and how we relate to others in the universe. And you know, this notion of community and how we participate in community and how we are in relationship. One of the things that we talked about when we were thinking about doing this workshop was just how we relate to each other in a recovery fashion. And one of the things, we're just both learning all the time, and we didn't start out in such a great place, but we learned. And again, it was uncomfortable for me a lot of times. One of the things that I have found is that we kind of always go back to the principles of the program when we're talking about anything and what we're going to do next. What I'm going to do next in a work situation or a family situation, like with my family of origin, what he's going to do with his kids or at his job. And a huge thing and beautiful thing about this program is that we have this common language, like this lingua franca, like we get it where each other, you know, where the other person is. And it is also brutal because we know where the other person is. And we are constantly, like, Pete M. talks about his immediatelys. This is this other guy who's led a lot of workshops. And when I was reading about, you know, call someone immediately, so Jim's my, like, my immediately, that I run things by him, you know, or, like, I can run things by a sponsor, but a lot of times, like, he's right there. And we have to hew to the principles in interactions with others to keep things clean, as we say. We always got to keep things clean. Because to do otherwise, I'm either being not true to myself or I'm going to cause pain that's unnecessary. Hmm. So to always have to be with somebody who can keep me centered is really incredible. It's also not always fun. But it really works. And it is a real gift to have, you know, to have that in the program. Now, not everybody's lucky enough to be with somebody else in the program, you know. We're not all in that situation. But the one thing I can tell you is I know, even in my interactions with others, because I have a lot of practice, is I've started to really understand when a 10th step is owed, for example, and... You know, I can use my 11th step and I can use my 12th step by talking with somebody else, by practicing a principle to know how to make that amends, how to do a little inventory and to reach out to this person to say where I was off. And to do so in a way that doesn't ask the person or insist that the person forgive me or that the person like me, but that I have to come from a true place, a place of recovery, or it just doesn't work out well. It just isn't. It takes me out of center. I don't know how else to put it. If we always say this too, one of our little catchphrases is like, you know, I'll consider this, say, an uncomfortable email that I need to write, and then I go into the what ifs. Just like Jim was talking about, like, what if, you know, and I catastrophize generally. It's not pretty. You know, I don't imagine it going, like, I tend to catastrophize. A friend of mine says, this woman I know says something like, you know, if this happens, then I'm going to get in trouble. I'm going to lose my job. I'm going to lose my house, lose my money. I'm going to die. And then my little dog's going to, nobody's going to find me. My dog's going to eat my face. You know, so we talk about going dog face, you know, like, we catastrophize. And, you know, and the simple response to that is, we're not in the results business. We're not in the results business. Dang, that's right, you know. But it is a way to really, like, be, to keep on that, you know. And good Lord, I'm so not perfect. And I make mistakes all the time. There are people in this room who know about this, you know. And I can... go to that place where I'm over-apologizing and all that. But at least today I know. And there's a difference. I'm not always, you know, wise enough or on the beam enough to keep it clean. And I do want to get into the results business a lot. You know, we're rewarded for that in this society, you know. You know, the metrics and the analytics and the answers and this and that. You know, we want answers. You know, and I'd be lying a lot of times if I said I had them. And I can't do that either. So it's sort of a vulnerable place to be, but it's a true place to be. And for me, that's the great reward. And I think that's kind of all I have.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Well, 7:27, so I'm going to take 2.5 minutes.
Yes.
and we'll finish up. So my favorite gardening tool is step 10.
Yeah.
And I get a fair bit of practice in, especially like the last year and a half, 2 years with COVID. Julie isn't working upstairs, I'm working downstairs, sometimes out in the garage. You know, so I have ample time and ample opportunities to practice step 10. Sometimes I get it immediately that I've done something that's absolutely off track. But there's the other times, maybe you guys can understand or relate to this, the other times when, you know what, this is different. She really is off base here. I don't think this deserves anything. You know, she's going to have to come to me. You know? And so, depends on how dug in I am at any particular day, how soon I'm going to come around to the fact that, you know, march up the stairs, sorry for being a ding-dong, or whatever it was. You know what I mean? And it's one of the things I find is it's not the crime, it's the cover-up. It's not like what I did. It's how long am I going to gnash teeth over this and make it into something way beyond what actually happened. You know what I mean? F this. You know, 3 weeks later, we haven't talked. You know what I mean? Or whatever. Now, I can honestly tell you that, so Julie and I, we're together since 2009?
Yeah.
2009. And I can't remember the last time we went for more than, I would say we haven't slept on a resentment in a long time. Like over years. You know what I mean? Because I can't handle the discomfort. Another one, I can't sleep well. I can't say I never went to sleep without holding on to something. I'd wake up at like 3 in the morning going, I knew this was going to happen. You know? Definitely should have come clean. Damn. You know, but I'm human, you know, and I definitely have a healthy ego. You know what I mean? I just do. But again, why it's my favorite gardening tool, it has instant, it is like flipping a switch. As soon as I come up and say to Julia, I'm sorry, she's instantly good. And until that time, I'm shut out. You know what I mean? Not in a nasty way, it's just like, it's just offline. You know? And I don't like that. I don't like that. I like the harmony. You know? And for me, and I'm not going to speak for Julia, but my peace of mind, my serenity is key and number one. If that's good, everything's good. And if that's not good, it's... That sounds like a... What was that movie? It sounds like something from a movie. If you don't want... Oh, that's it. I can't think of the name of the movie. But anyway, he goes, if you can't love everybody, you can't love anybody. Do you know what I mean? It's like, yeah, that makes sense to me. You know what I mean? Just that idea that there's no kind of in-between things. You know what I mean? You're either all in or you're kind of, you know, got two, you know, 1 foot in a grave and 1 foot in a banana peel. You know, you're on shaky, very, very not good ground. So again, that's my take on the gardening, and we're going to turn it over to you folks to hear what you guys have to say. Any questions, comments?
Questions, comments, concerns.
Yeah.